Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future, and we're not afraid to take a positive view of the future, to take a positive view of what's happening now, and give you the straight scoop about what's happening in the world. And that straight scoop is that maybe the sky just isn't falling. And maybe if you're ready to look at the evidence, you'll see that we live in a world that could just be getting better all the time. Moreover, we believe we stand on the brink of what could be an incredibly bright future. If we play our cards right, a future that most of us haven't even imagined, much less dared to hope for, but one that we're all very much going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
Doing great, Phil. I hope you had a great Independence Day weekend.
I most certainly did. How about yourself?
Oh, yeah, we got out there and, you know, put out some fireworks and had a good time. Had a barbecue on Saturday. Just, you know, it's been a great weekend.
Fantastic. And I believe we got Michael Darling on the line as well. Michael, how was your 4th of July weekend?
It was almost perfect.
Almost perfect. Well, we don't want to hear
it's
about
not
the
over
blemish
yet. The future is unknown, and it's got, you know, a couple hours to go.
Yeah, it could hit a real slide at this point. You just never know. But we don't look at the world that way. Actually, I'm going to inject a quick sports story. I meant to put this on the lineup for tonight, Stephen. I hope it's okay if I interject something I meant to mention. On Friday for the 4th, went to see the Colorado Rockies play the Florida Marlins, and I don't know if you've heard, you probably don't follow them that closely. They've had a real bad first half of the season, have not been doing well, but they've been on a tear here lately, and they've won 5 of their last 6 games. And
that's
the
great
game, they're doing much better. The game Friday, they beat the Marlins 18-17, and it was just
what
about
a game.
Oh yeah, it was
well,
just about the most
not
exciting
even half
baseball
of it
game.
They were losing 13-4.
We came back from a 9-run deficit. That is a
that
fact,
never
history,
happens. That never happens.
Well, history was made two ways that night. History was made two ways. First, that's the biggest comeback that the Rockies in franchise history. And in fact, that was pretty impressive that they came back from 9 runs down and closed to within about 1, and then the Marlins went up about 5 runs on them, and they had to close that gap again too. So, I mean, it was just...
You were there the whole time for this.
Oh, yeah, you had to be. Well, anyway, there were fireworks afterwards. So
oh, man.
Everybody was going to stick around anyway. But, the only time they were in the lead was when they won, right at the bottom of the ninth, and finally a single, and the bases were loaded, and it was like, wow, unbelievable. But the other way that history was made, in addition to the greatest comeback of all time, this is the bit of history that Florida doesn't want you talking about, but they joined a very elite group on Friday. They are now one of 4 teams in Major League Baseball for the last 100 years who have done this same thing, and that is score 17 runs and lose. So, big congrats to the Florida Marlins.
Well, I'll give you one other one for the Rockies. Star shortstop Troy Tulowitzki, and I'm guessing that less than 10 players have done this, but goes into the dugout and for some reason smashes a bat. The bat bounces back up, the shattered piece, and lacerates his hand, 16 stitches. He's out for many, many weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
That doesn't happen that often.
No, that doesn't. That's not that great of a record either, I suppose. Well, Tulo's been having kind of a slump, so I hope he.
I had a friend who broke a bone. I had a friend after a game that he was involved in back in high school, broke a bone in his foot the same way, kicking something.
This is why we got to keep our heads cool about these sporting
events. That's right.
It can be awfully frustrating. But it wasn't frustrating Friday night. It was a very exciting game. So Got that going on. And I think in addition to the 4th of July, we wanted to note another important event that occurred earlier in the week.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Monday was the 100th anniversary of the Tunguska event. Am I pronouncing that right, Phil?
As far as I know. I've never heard anyone say it. I've only ever
I've only seen it in print all my life. But,
yeah.
I think I have heard it one time, though. And of all places, I heard the one time I've actually heard the word spoken was in the Ghostbusters movie, which, again, is
there you go.
It's a text. I mean,
that is the source of all knowledge. I mean, before Wikipedia, this is where we turned, was the Ghostbusters.
Right. So. But at any rate, that meteorite, they've about decided that it was a meteorite, that it was about 90 feet across was all it was.
Right.
But the devastation was 800 square miles of forest. Unfortunately, it was just forest. As far as anyone that knows, no one died.
Yeah, anywhere from 5 megatons to 30 megatons. There, you know, those are the rough
estimates. The number I see here in this article is 185 Hiroshima bombs.
Right. Right,
which is, you know, obvious, and the thought is that this is a 1 in 300 year event, and thank goodness it's no more often than that. And fortunately, most of the Earth is ocean, so if it were to happen again, it would probably hit there, or hopefully some.
Well, I wonder. I wonder what the impact would be actually if it landed. If you had that blast over the ocean, would that cause a huge tsunami?
Well, this one exploded above the forest. It didn't.
That's what I'm saying. If it had exploded over water.
Yeah, it didn't actually. It didn't actually impact the ground in Russia.
But it flattened all those trees.
Yeah.
Flattened all those trees. Would it have?
It probably would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It probably would. Yeah.
I think there was a book in the 70s or 80s that some guy had meticulously put together a theory. This would be a good Tales of the Paranormal if we were going that direction, but put together the theory that that it was a spacecraft. And he had the argument that that place in Siberia was about the only place you could, of course, the theory at that time was something hit, right? Not that it was an explosion over the surface of the land.
Right.
But that was about the only place you could hit and not kill anybody.
Yeah.
And so this alien was flying his craft. He knew he was going to crash, and he very carefully made sure that he landed there, you know, that he crashed there so as not to kill anybody.
So, yeah.
A very self-sacrificing alien.
Yeah. And that very nice of him, but not likely. Probably a meteorite.
Most likely a meteor, yeah.
Although I like the alien explanation a lot better. That would have been...
Well, it's cool, you know. Yeah. And that's where I got the water thing, because the guy said it would have caused this huge wave if it had hit, and I wonder if that the explosion still would have caused a huge wave. But what's interesting about that is that's not a very big meteor, 90 feet.
Yeah, it's not. They're tracking many that are up to a kilometer wide, in which those would be civilization enders if they were to hit us, if they're a kilometer wide. Now, the likelihood of being hit by one of these is, you know, apparently it comes up very, very rarely, and the likelihood is that the next time one of those big ones are on track to hit us, we'll be in the position to deflect it. That's the deal with those. Have you ever seen a big one come in, Phil? I know you've seen shooting stars, but have you ever seen?
Yeah, I've never seen one hit that I know of. I've seen, you know, meteors. I've seen the meteor showers and that sort of thing. But no, I've never actually seen one hit. Have you?
Yes, I have. I saw a really big one it would have been about 1991, 1992, and that thing. It came across the sky, and I actually heard it burning in the atmosphere, and it was huge. It lit up the night, and I stopped the car and waited for it. I had my windows down. I saw it come out of the. I believe that would have been the west. Excuse me. Actually, it was. It looked like it was almost going north to south to north, which doesn't make any sense. But anyway, I stopped the car and waited for the explosion. I thought it was going to be something, you know, that was going to rock the planet. But apparently, the entire nation saw it. It came in at kind of an oblique angle. And, I mean, from people from out west all the way to, you know, to the eastern coast saw it, and it was just I thought it was going to hit real close, but no, it just apparently went through the atmosphere and burned up completely and never touched. But it must have been a big one.
It didn't hit.
No, it didn't hit.
So you misled us with that. We thought we were going to get a story.
I'm sorry. I did not see one hit. I saw a big one though.
I wanted one to like hit your roof or something. I mean, I
that. No, that's not happened so far.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want one to hit your roof. That's the story.
You wanted a good story like that, though, right?
Well, I saw a really bright one. Would have been about 2 years ago. About 2 years ago, I was in Las Vegas, and I was actually coming out of Caesar's Palace, and you see this bright light in the sky, which is not unusual in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I'm about to say, you sure it wasn't just neon?
Well, no, it was not, and that speaks to how bright it was. That any celestial object you can see in the Las Vegas sky has got to be
pretty
pumping
bright.
Out the lumens. You know, I mean, yeah, it's got to be very bright. But again, it was not one that I could. I mean, you could see it ended before it made it to the ground. But that was pretty cool seeing one in Las Vegas because, you know, it's just one of those all the weird stuff that happens in Vegas. There's another one. So.
Yep.
But enough meteor stories, unless Michael's got a good one he wants to share with us.
You seen a big one, Mike?
I got nothing. No, I don't think, other than seeing the Perseid shower, I don't think I've ever seen anything.
Yeah. You get out there on a nice, clear night. I mean, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be even a special occasion. If you get out there on a clear night and and you've got a good view of the entire sky, you will see falling stars. It happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's stuff entering the atmosphere all the time. Most of the ones you see are very small. Some, like even microscopic, can cause a
little streak,
a big light.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to our next topic, which I believe is movies. We're tracking the summer of movies here. Summer 2008, big movie summer, as reported by Stephen 2 weeks ago, and we're tracking new releases as they come out. This week, I saw one. Stephen, you saw one. Actually, and Michael and I both saw one, so we caught up with you on WALL-E. Maybe we should talk about that first real quick, just to say that I think we're all in agreement that that's a really great movie.
You saw it too, then?
Yeah, I did. I did.
Okay. Yeah.
I saw it yesterday.
Michael, I mean, you had a really good impression of it as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's the best G-rated movie ever made. And I say that because I don't know how you'd compare WALL-E to The Godfather or, you know, something of that ilk.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, for me, it's top 10 all categories. It's the best G-rated movie ever made.
I thought it was outstanding. I thought it was a masterpiece. I don't know if it's even my favorite Pixar movie, though. Pixar is, I mean, just they just steadily have put out, you know, one brilliant movie after the next. And, you know, there are some that are probably not, you know, for all time, you know, a gift for all time to humanity kind of movies, like Cars was not one of those. But, you know, it's a pretty good movie.
Speak
but
for yourself, man. I don't know.
Yeah, Cars was entertaining, but, you know, it didn't speak to the human.
It will go down in Hollywood history as the movie that Paul Newman and Larry the Cable Guy were in together. I mean, you know,
that's right. Yeah. It's not likely to be too many more than where those two guys are doing.
A series of movies, yeah.
That's right. If you're ever in a situation where you have to, you know, you're playing a game where you're connecting the actors, that would be a good one to bring those two together. But anyway, he went it one move by knowing that. But
exactly.
What was I saying? Oh, The Incredibles is still my favorite Pixar movie.
Okay. Yeah, I love The Incredibles. I'm not going to go as far as Michael on the best G-rated movie. I think it is my favorite Pixar movie. As I think about it, I think WALL-E might take the number one spot for Pixar movies, but it can't be the best G-rated movie of all time because, of course, the finest G-rated movies ever made starred Charlton Heston. So.
Yeah.
But for a movie without him in it, it was awfully darn good. I would say that.
You're saying you missed him in that pool scene.
I guess I did. I was looking, but I didn't see him. Okay.
I wish Charlton Heston had lived and they could have cast him in that movie. I mean, he would have been perfect in the role of the captain or something, you know.
Yeah, it would have been awesome. It would have been great. But what I liked especially about it was, you know, I had heard there's some kind of You know, some people are objecting to it on political grounds, which is just absurd. But
what would be the political statement they're objecting to?
Well, I guess this kind of gloom and doom view that we're going to wipe ourselves out, and there'll be this environmental disaster. But to me, that's silly. I mean, this is you have these parables to warn us against doing those things.
Right.
So you show the consequences of that. Therefore, I mean, I think some people just worry too much. But what I really liked about it was I thought it's just a very affirming of humanity kind of a message to that movie. Even when humanity gets itself into this state that it's gotten itself into, as soon as you give these people an option, they want something else. That's what
right.
I really liked about that movie. That they didn't have to be pulled kicking and screaming out of that state into something else, that they absolutely wanted it. You know, they didn't like being trapped into the state they had fallen into. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
All right, I just want to say real fast that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking a little bit about movies, and we're going to get into the subject of the mundane singularity here in just a few minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, please join us in the live chat room, or we'll be opening up the phone lines a little bit later at 347-215-8972. So let's move on to other movies real quick. Speaking of superhero movies, I saw Hancock, making the transition from your reference to The Incredibles earlier.
Yeah.
I liked the first hour of Hancock,
yeah.
I would say, maybe 45 minutes to an hour. And then it's okay. I think people are kind of hard on it. The rest of it is okay. It's just not the end of the story, I think, is the big thing. And to me, the problem is, once we find out who he is, okay, because
yeah.
we do learn who Hancock is and why he is able to do all these things, and that's given context.
They explain his origin a little bit, huh?
A little, not very much, but a little. And he is not that, okay? The character that Will Smith is playing in the first hour of the movie is just not what it's explained to be. And I can't say any more than that without giving it away, but just the way he behaves doesn't make any sense based on who we've learned that he is. And I don't want to spoil too much, but I'll just say they should have watched Highlander, okay? Should have watched Highlander, and then they might have had a better idea. That's all
yeah.
I'm going to say. I don't know if I've said too much. I might have ruined it. But
not
the first
likely.
Hour is great. And,
I'm not even going to catch this one on until it comes out on DVD, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I think you, the money will be well saved.
Yeah.
But Jason Bateman was awesome. He was really funny. And the interactions between him and Will Smith in the beginning of the movie, when it's just this kind of regular guy trying to help a superhero act like a superhero, if they'd have done 2 hours of that, it just would have been a really great movie. I think it would have been right up there with Iron Man and the Hulk and the other superhero movies we have this summer. But it turned
yeah,
into something else.
You wouldn't even have to explain, why he's a superhero. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. in that universe, he just is a superhero, and you don't have to get into why. It could just been a story about how he stops being a jerk and starts being a nice guy superhero.
Yeah, or just throw it away. You know, it just boom. Here's the origin, and it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
So
right.
Yeah, exactly. I think either one of those. One of the reviews I read really summed it up. It said it's the more you learn about who he is and why he is the way he is, the less you care.
Right.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But that is kind of what happens. But there is a big surprise there, and I actually liked the big surprise. I thought the big surprise was very cool when it happened because my wife predicted it. She
yeah.
turned to me and said that was going to happen right before it did, and she was absolutely right. So big props to her for nailing that surprise before it came. All right, so tell us about Wanted.
Wanted is... Well, I tell you about it. Wanted is not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm going to tell you, here's a big warning. It is about as blue as anything I've watched on the big screen in a long time. I mean, they get through two or three sentences somewhere in the movie without the F word, I'm sure, but I can't quite remember what sentences those might be. So if you're at all offended by, language like that, don't go see it, and sure don't drag your mother to see it or your kids or something like that.
Not a movie for your mom. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So that said, it is kind of Fight Club meets The Matrix kind of deal, and I liked both Fight Club and The Matrix. The problem with Wanted is that, you know, like Matrix, it sort of has a mythology. There's a reason why the things are the way they are within the movie. But it wasn't developed very well. And
right.
They only get into it about halfway into the movie, and you're there having a good time because, you know, and so maybe you buy it, maybe not, but it could have been done better. And that's kind of a shame. So, you know, I suppose there is a possibility of a series of movies coming out of this. I'm not sitting here with bated breath waiting on it.
Well, if those sequels are any near as good as the Matrix sequels, huh? We've really got something to look forward to.
Right. The Matrix stands alone. I try to forget the sequels whenever I...
Oh, here's a question Michael's asking in the chat room. Is this better or worse than The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Better. Much better.
Well, but, and I'm discounting the fact that Angelina Jolie wasn't in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the other questions in the chat room here is how much of her do we actually see? Let me just put it this way. Do we see more of her than we did in Beowulf?
You see about the same amount, and this time it's not computer-generated. You
All
really...
Right.
You really do see that butt, I tell you. And which is, you know, depending on you know how you feel about that, it might be worth the price of admission right there. So that's the movie Wanted. I would not, the language is something else, and I'm not that usually doesn't even bother me, but my gosh,
Well, some people can pull it off. You know, if it's a Robert De Niro film, you kind
yeah.
of expect it, right?
You hear the F word thrown out as sort of an ethnic, palate cleanser, you know, every third word. But
right,
this is,
exactly.
But, yeah, this wasn't like that. And
like, seriously, Midnight Run, where he's talking
yeah,
about...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that was a great movie where the language didn't matter, it seemed like. But this one sort of... I don't know. It just sort of seemed weird in a movie that was almost a superhero kind of movie. Anyway.
Yeah, he says, I got two words for you. Shut the bleep up.
That's right. Midnight Run. That was a great line in that movie.
Yeah.
We got something coming out this week coming out here in the next day or so. It's Gotham Knight, which is the lead up to the next Batman movie. It comes out on Tuesday.
Gotham Knight, what is it?
It is a 6-part anime movie that bridges the gap between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight.
No kidding. And this is a theatrical release?
It comes out on DVD day after tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. They really spent the time on it. It's 6 interlocking anime episodes back to back to back. And elements of each, I mean, it's like a different adventure with a different bad guy, where he's going after different bad guys in each of these 6 tales. But it builds an overall story that is resolved, apparently, in the 6th one. So 6 chapters, and then leading right straight into what The Dark Knight will be coming out July 18th. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. I'm gonna catch it on Tuesday and go watch it Tuesday night.
Oh, okay. Well, you can report back on that. And then is Dark Knight, is that this weekend or no, it's next?
Let's see, July 18th. When's that? That's the that's not this coming weekend,
Friday.
But the following one, right?
Because we could probably spend an hour talking about the new Batman movie, seeing as we all know that in the future we'll all be Batman.
That's right.
We've blogged on that at the Speculist before, but that's something to look forward to, a new Batman movie. That's... as Michael says in the chat room, Batman is a choice. That's right. Superman is a destiny. Batman is a choice. You see, that's kind of the difference between the two. Okay. Hancock is a... I'm trying to think what he would be. Kind of a mistake, I guess.
That's the impression I get. He's just a jerk. Yeah.
So let's shift gears. And he is a jerk, but that part's funny. When he's being a jerk, that's
it actually worked as a movie when he was being a jerk, huh?
The idea of the drunken superhero flying through the air with his bottle of Jim Beam in one hand and the bad guy's car in the other, you know, and he's kind of stagger flying because he's had too much to drink. I mean, that stuff is, I think that's really funny. It really worked for me, but unfortunately, they don't stay with that. So let's move on. We'll talk a little about the mundane singularity. And I'm going to let you set this up, Stephen. What do we mean when we say a mundane singularity?
Well, this is an idea that comes from Brian Wang. And this is the same Brian Wang that was our guest last week on the show. We didn't even bring it up that we were going to have the show about this last week to him. We probably should have. But anyway, it's his idea. The critics of the singularity, the whole idea of the technological singularity, have said that, you know, the singularity idea is based on pie-in-the-sky technology, like spooky nanotech, where we get nanotech assemblers that build stuff molecule by molecule, or artificial general intelligence. You know, they have a problem with those things, and they say those are the enabling technologies that will make a singularity possible. And Brian Wang says, hold up, we still could have a singularity even if we weren't to have those things. Now, he doesn't buy their premise. He thinks that the molecular assembly and artificial general intelligence will happen. But he says,
right,
even if they don't, then we'll still have a singularity, and it would be a very interesting singularity even without those things. And so that's what he calls a mundane technological singularity, would be a technological singularity without those two, quote, enabling technologies.
So we might distinguish between a mundane singularity, which is one that's going to require AGI, artificial general intelligence, or molecular nanotechnology, and
right,
that mundane doesn't require those, and a,
right,
and a spooky one, right, that would require those. I'm going to throw the word spooky on the opposite of a mundane singularity.
Right.
Is that the right distinction, do you think? Or
that's the right distinction. Now, I guess we've got to go back and just define real quick what a singularity is, what the technological singularity would be, and I guess the most basic definition, Werner Vinge came up with the idea, and basically when we, by whatever means, accomplish greater than human level intelligence, that will be the technological singularity. And then after that, people that are our level of intelligence will not be able to, you know, predict beyond that what will happen, because the smarter beings will be taking the lead at that point. So that's basically what the technological singularity is. And Brian Wang is saying that even without artificial general intelligence, you could have a singularity, which is pretty surprising, because usually when we talk about that, we mean computers being, you know, becoming more intelligent than people. That
right,
being
and I think
moment.
I think that Brian is probably using a slightly different definition of singularity.
Okay.
Because obviously, you don't get to greater than human intelligence if you don't. I think you don't get to it if you don't have AGI. So.
Well, if you could, if there are ways you could get greater than human level intelligence just through drugs or
that's true. Human enhancement. That's a good point.
You could enhance humans to the point that they become greater than human. You know, more intelligent than humans are now. And in fact, I guess you could make the argument that we've already reached that point to some extent. There are some drugs that you can take that will do make you smarter, at least more where you're more clear, I guess, is the way to think about it, that you can think more clearly and you can stay up for days at a time without sleep and on. There are drugs like that already.
That sort of thing does exist. And what's interesting is when we talk about true augmentation of human intelligence, we really can't predict what comes after that, including AGI and molecular nanotech, because you really do reach the singularity at that point. Once we're dealing with human beings that are, you know, a quantum or two smarter than we are, we really can't predict what they're going to, because we can't even predict what people at the current level of intelligence are going to do next, much less
right,
what enhanced, augmented, super intelligent human beings are going to do. So this puts me in mind of a post I did back in the early days of the Speculous, and I drag it out every now and then because it's just, I like the list. I made this list, and I called it, and now the extremely good news. And my breakdown on it was, these are all things that we can expect to see in our lifetimes, at least they're possible within our lifetimes, and that they can be achieved either through technologies that we currently have or that technologies that are like logically implied by the technologies that we have. And I think there's some overlap between the items that that I talk about on my list and the ones that Brian talks about on his list. In fact, what I like about Brian's list is you see a lot of the same items showing up, but they're all links to stories about people who are actually making these things happen, which is great. You know, I would say something like eradication of hunger worldwide. Well, Brian talks about that, and he's got a link to the story about these vertical farms where you can take abandoned office buildings and turn them into farms that'll produce amazingly huge amounts of food. And I think that the idea that the world can be radically transformed is kind of what he's getting at with the word singularity, as much as the idea of reaching a point of greater than human intelligence. I think
I agree completely. I think that's kind of where he was going, even more than. Yeah, I agree. He's not really defining technological singularity the same way as Werner Vinge, but he's just talking about a remarkable future we have, even if we don't get these things. And so he goes
exactly
through this list.
This transformed world, this world that we wouldn't even recognize because things have become so awesome in it. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil and Steven talking about the mundane singularity. If you'd like to join our conversation, join us in the chat room or give us a call at 347-215-8972. So let's start with that kind of first item on his list. It's not actually the first on mine, but I do talk about eradicating hunger and having adequate clean water, housing, clothing for all, medical care for all, access to technology to all who want it, and eventually total economic independence for individuals and groups who desire it. Now, are those kinds of things, according to what Brian is laying out, possible? And if so, how do we get to that?
I'm sorry, Phil, you caught me at a moment where I was switching between two different things. I apologize.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was just saying in my list I had outlined this view of a kind of an economic singularity where we could eradicate hunger, we could essentially eliminate poverty, where all the material needs of humanity essentially could be met.
One of the things he brings up is the old idea I keep bringing up, and I just keep harping on it to speculators every chance I get, is the fab labs. I'm talking also about another word for replicating rapid replicators. Anyway, it's not nanotech by any means. What it is again, you download from the internet or someplace like that a digital file that's instructions for how to print something, and you print a 3D item, and right there when you need it, and there you have it. So, and it could be something as small as like a toothbrush, or you could have big machines that could literally print out homes and other buildings, and this technology is sort of already here, but it's one of those things that will come about and will really transform our world in the next 10 years, I believe.
I think it's going to be huge. But I just want to back up from the specific technologies. I want to catch one thing that Brian talks about that I think is really interesting. He talks about abundance in terms of kilowatt hours.
Oh yeah,
which I think is an interesting way to define it. And he talks about every living person having personal resources at the affluent level of a current U.S. citizen, about $250,000 per person per year. Which those are some fairly well-off U.S. citizens, actually. They're doing better than I am, actually, these citizens that Brian wants to create. But he talks about it in terms of the fact that we use about 13,000 kilowatt hours per year for electricity and three times that for transportation. So what's that, 39,000? About 52,000 kilowatt hours per person per year in the U.S.
Right.
And that is our actual affluence right there. For Brian.
That is a good way to measure it. And that's been kind of my problem with like the environmental movement. I'm all for saving the planet and everything else. But when you start saying, okay, you need to use less electricity, what you're meaning is, we need, it's a Luddite You know, that's having to, you know, relinquish technology basically, because, you know, one of the things that you know that the society is advancing is when people have more energy available to them.
Exactly, and, right. Certainly, there's a case to be made for, a huge case to be made for cleaner sources of energy and using energy much more efficiently than we do, and using all resources much more efficiently.
Recycling things and all that, you know, that needs to be done. Yeah.
Good stuff. Keeping the environment clean. Good. And in fact, one of the things on my list was re-cleaning the environment back up again. But the way forward is through more people having more access to energy. There's no question about it. And the world, the developing world, is going to insist on it. They're going to find a way to make it happen, irrespective of the West's insistence that we step back from energy. And in fact, even irrespective from what might be their own political rhetoric about how the world needs to step back from it. It just doesn't matter. They're going to move ahead. And he talks in terms of
and who can blame him? You know.
Well, I don't blame him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm using my 52,000 kilowatt hours per year, and I'll cut it way down. You know, as long as I, you know, can sell my podcast and, you know, I mean, have to keep my job, and I don't mind using fewer kilowatt hours, but I'm not going to become Amish, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think that we're likely as a society to turn back from using electronics, from using automobiles, you know, from this civilization that we've created. We're not going to step back from it. And people who are coming online are going to...
If we were to try to, it would be an environmental disaster if we tried to. I think that's something that the environmental guys don't get. Is that,
well, that's interesting. How would that be an environmental disaster if we tried to? I mean, I can see how it would be a human disaster, but how would it be an environmental disaster?
Well, given the population we have, we have to use technology to take care of our needs. And for example, what about all the people that are living in places that get cold in the wintertime? You take away our technological solutions to staying warm, and they'll go to burning firewood, and you know they'll strip the forests, and it would be a disaster. And you
juxtapose that, not just stepping back, but even staying with what we currently have. Even juxtapose current methods of manufacturing automobiles or any kind of consumer goods with the kinds of things Brian is talking about here, and you really see this incredibly improved environmental future through developing new means of producing goods and empowering people and allowing people to enjoy a more affluent lifestyle rather than telling them that they have to be deprived. Because he's talking about printable buildings, he's talking about inflatable electric cars, printable electronic devices, all the rip-rap stuff that we've talked about, and you know it's a model of creating abundance, of allowing other people to enjoy what we have enjoyed, and having a much more clean and efficient way of producing that stuff. I don't know if you read up on the inflatable cars, but that is just one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've heard about another prototype that a company is planning on rolling out in the next couple of years. That's a fabric car. It's complete. You know, it's like an old fabric airplane, basically. You know, what you have basically is the framework of the car covered with thick, heavy fabric. But it's still, I mean, you're cutting down the weight of the car substantially, and by doing it that way, and therefore it's much more fuel efficient. And
absolutely. Same with these inflatable cars. And of course, these inflatable cars can be produced all at a piece, more or less, and shipped flat. One of the things they talk about there,
a little box, shows up. The UPS guy shows up delivering your car.
You got to get some compressed air and blow up your car, and then you're ready to go. But yeah, they're so much lighter that they run well off. You know, just a small amount of fuel. They run well. They're good. They're good vehicles to introduce into the developing world because they're so inexpensive, and because they can be produced in large quantities without this big environmental footprint that you would have had in the past trying to manufacture enough cars the old way to meet this growing demand. So, yeah, it's going to be very interesting. We're going to see fabric cars. We're going to see inflatable cars. We're going to see a lot more movement towards cars running on electricity. Hybrids, I think, are going to become electric cars. And I think the grid itself, the power grid itself, is going to start being powered a lot differently than it is now. I look to see the U.S. grid starting to look more like what they got over in France. That's what I think.
More nuclear? Is that what you're saying?
70% of their power comes from nuclear power. It's one of the reasons that France has stayed on top. You know, they're the fifth largest. Is that right? Fifth largest economy in the world. One of the reasons that they're near the top of the list is because they are producing so much energy. They produce 70% of their own energy through nuclear, and they export a ton of energy elsewhere into Europe and make money doing that. It's a great example for the rest of us, you know, for the U.S. to look at that and go, hey, why aren't we doing this? You know, for everyone to look at that and say, hey, why, you know, let's follow the French example here.
Let's be more like the French in this way.
At least this one way.
In this one way, yes. And we can learn how to cook the way they do, too. I'm kind of partial to that.
Absolutely.
You know, back in the 50s, in the late 50s, early 60s, they had what they called the Boat of the Month Club. Have you ever heard of that? Boat of the Month Club. It was what the Navy called their program to put out nuclear-powered submarines. Okay? They were putting them out at the rate of one a month. And you know, if we could, as a nation, do that and, you know, put out these small – and the thing about those nuclear reactors on board those boats, they are meltdown-proof. They're not big enough to cause a nuclear meltdown. So if we put – I mean, if we were capable as a country 50 years ago, basically, to do this, you know, to build these one a month, we could do small reactors like that all over the country, and we could, if we made it a priority, we could make it happen very quickly, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that that Brian talks about, and this is something that we have linked to in the past, is this uranium hydride nuclear battery.
Right.
A company called Hyperion produces these, and this is the same thing that you use to power a nuclear sub, but it's a small. Actually, if you follow the link on Brian's site, you actually see a guy standing next to one in scale, so you get the idea. You know, it's about twice as tall as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the thing, I don't know.
They bring it out to your site and they bury it or something like that, and you run off of it, you know, for years.
It provides 70 megawatts of thermal energy or 25 megawatts of electrical energy for a steam turbine for 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So that's enough energy to power like 20,000 average American-style homes or the industrial or infrastructure equivalent, it says there. So, I mean, you think about 20,000 homes, that's a pretty good chunk of homes for this thing that is, no kidding, it's probably if you took like, I'm sorry, this is the one thing that's coming to mind. I wish I could think of something else, but it looks like it's about 4 or 5 porta-potties, okay, in size. I mean,
it certainly could be delivered by train.
Put
it on a train and bring it in. And part of what this company does is they install it on site, and you know, and I think they usually bury it, and then when they come to retrieve it, they'll dig it up and take it off and replace it with another one. Apparently, is the idea.
Right. It produces no waste other than itself. I guess there's waste inside of it. There's no water running through it. It can't melt down. It's a huge leap forward in nuclear technology, and the fact that it can be so widely distributed means that, you could, you know, plop one down and have it powering 20,000 houses, but there's also this idea that you can enable a lot of manufacturing infrastructure, and you can even enable things like one of the ideas they were talking about was digging up shale to make oil out of it, using these to power the equipment that would be used to actually excavate the shale.
The way it would work is, Phil, they put down electrodes into the shale, and then you have to obviously have a lot of electricity going down into those electrodes. Then the oil starts flowing like liquid oil, and then they just pump it out of the ground with a conventional oil well.
Shale, right?
Yeah.
By warming the shale.
It warms the shale, and then you can pump it out of the ground like conventional oil with a well, and just a regular well. So that's and you have to obviously have a lot of electricity to do that, and that could be a solution for that. That's great, yeah. And we have enough in the West out there where you and Michael are living. We have enough oil out there in the form of shale that we're up there with Saudi Arabia with the level of our reserves if you count that shale oil.
Absolutely, so, absolutely. So. Yeah, I mean we could just start tapping a little of that. It seems to me would be a nice move forward at this point before we get to the point where we've got 30-story oil-producing algae farms producing all the oil we need, which will actually be cheaper even than extracting the shale. And at some point, we'll even replace that with something else. A lot of things on the horizon here where energy is concerned.
And the fact that there are so many potential solutions coming online at the same time, and it's kind of an exciting thing. You get to see how it's going to shake out, and with so many potential possibilities, it's hard to be depressed, even with the gas inching up in price. You know, it begins to look like just a process by which to get us to the next thing, rather than a permanent crisis, which is what you tend to hear in the mainstream media so much. So.
Well, you would think I saw a bumper sticker this morning. I was coming out of the gym. I saw a bumper sticker. It really got my attention. It said, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." And I think I was all the way home composing alternatives to this bumper sticker in my head. And I think the one I came up with, I'm going to go to Cafe Press or someplace and get this made. If you're not giddy with enthusiasm, you're not paying attention. I think.
Yeah, if you're not excited, or there's something. Yeah, exactly. That's you're just not paying attention, or you're listening
you're getting
to the wrong
news from the
source.
Wrong source. You need to listen to Fast Forward Radio.
Yeah.
This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Our phone lines are open 347-215-8972. If you want to join our conversation about the mundane future, give us a call and let's talk. So what else on Brian's list caught your eye, Stephen?
Well, I was taken with those vertical farms. The idea, of course, is that you have most people live in urban settings nowadays, and part of the problem with part of the expense factor of food is that it's got to be trucked in from the Midwest or wherever our grain belt happens to be. You're trucking in this food into, say, a place like New York City. That is, that is a lot of energy that's being expended for that. What if New York City could produce some of its food right there within the city, and you just take and you would take a building, a multi-story building, and turn it into a giant greenhouse, and it would be climate controlled. It would be completely organic because there would be no need for pesticides because bugs can't get in there to it, and there it is. You grow it and you feed the city right there, and so there's not a lot of not a lot of energy cost to something like that. So,
well, I'll tell you, one of the things that really caught my attention when I was reading on about that one is apparently there are enough abandoned buildings in the New York area that you could feed New York. Just turn all the abandoned buildings into these food farms, and you could probably produce enough food to feed the whole city of New York. And that kind of gives you the idea of, not that.
I hope it's not something that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I was going to say, not that it's easy to implement, but that the world is kind of setting itself up and waiting for this to happen. You would almost
right.
Say.
Somebody is going to take the step. Now, I'm hopeful that it's not a government entity that just mandates it. I hope that we get some entrepreneurs who get in there and decide we're gonna farm right here, I'm sure there's a store somewhere in New York City that sells overalls. Get your hoe, get your overalls, and turn an abandoned building into a food factory, and see how that works. I'm anxious to see somebody somewhere try that and see how it goes. So,
yeah, what I want to see is I want to see a big land war going on over abandoned buildings when people who are trying to raise algae for energy versus the people who want to put a bunch of these hydride battery nuclear power plants in and provide power. Now, when we see abandoned office space being fought over for those three things, I think we know that the mundane singularity is near, if not the if not,
not the real one, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that got my attention was, of course, Brian talks a lot about improvements to the overall human condition, to our health, to our bodies, to our brains. And in fact, he had written some really interesting comments on last week's program after our conversation about myostatin inhibitors and other things. And he talks about, for example, drugs that will mimic the effects of calorie restriction that should be available within 5 years. And of course, we know calorie restriction in mice and some other animals has a lifespan lengthening effect on them. It's a hard practice to maintain for human beings, so it hasn't caught on widely as a means of extending life. But drugs that will mimic that effect, and he says that those should provide 3 to 13 years of increased lifespan. So that's not huge. That's not actuarial escape velocity, but it's a big step forward, and it's one that we expect to see within 5 years. Then he talks about treatment.
And I gotta mention this, that would be within the time frame of my prediction of first generation life extension when it arrives, and so I'm happy about that.
Well, there you go. All right. So once again, you know, you're kind of the poor man's Kurzweil.
That's right. Very poor. Very poor man.
You know, you're putting them out there, and they're coming true. And by golly, it's.
I got to toot my horn every now and then. But anyway,
yeah,
go ahead.
But that's beautiful. Make some more predictions like that, because I love to see him. I love to see him coming into play. Now he talks about the treatments to boost the human immune system against cancer and effective and cheap early detection of cancer cells.
He's talking about Dr. Shui there.
Dr. Kui is one of them. But you'd also put a story up about a guy who was effectively cured of cancer using his own immune system.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, what they did was they took immune cells out of his own body, put them in a petri dish, cultured them, and put them back into him. And I suppose if you have a healthy immune system, that would be a possibility for somebody who's fighting cancer. If you don't, then you're going to need to go is it Dr. Shui or Dr. Kui?
Kui, Dr. Jing Kui.
Dr. Kui. You'd have to go with his treatment, which is called GIFT, which is granulocyte infusion therapy, is what that stands for. And what that is you get donor cells from someone from a healthy person's immune system and transfuse it into your body and for the same effect to kill cancer. And the cool thing about this is it's not going to have to go through a huge long FDA approval process. You know,
right.
There's no drug that's going to have to go through, you know, trials and things. If it works and they find it to work, this could be something we'll see in the next year or so.
Absolutely.
And if it has the same effect in humans as it has in mice, we're talking about, you know, saving most of the people who come down with cancer. It's that big of a deal. Yeah.
It's absolutely that big. If it's as effective, I mean, that's a big if, but
yeah.
If it's as effective for humans as it is for mice, then that's exactly what we're talking about. And his trial has started. I should have put something up on the Speculist about that,
yeah.
But I actually saw that over either on Randall's site or on Brian's site within the past couple of weeks. That
Dr. Kui had said that he would have to wait until this summer, and that's what he did. He waited until this summer and then started the human trial. So.
Yeah, because interestingly, I guess immune system granulocyte harvesting is much more effective in the summer than in the cold months. So
it's a sunshine thing. I don't understand, but that's exactly right. So.
Yeah. So something to look forward to. We can't wait to get results from that one, and hopefully we'll have him back on the program to talk about those results. That is going to be huge. But I want to go back to the other one because I think that's so interesting. Taking someone's own immune system, building
right.
it up in a petri dish, injecting that back into them, and it effectively eliminates cancer. Doesn't that almost make you think, hey, what if you just started doing that to a healthy person? Would that
yeah.
be a bad idea? Wouldn't that be a good idea? You know, I mean,
yeah, exactly. And you know, Dr. Kui had said this back when you were visiting with him about 6 months ago. There is a reason we have a flu season in the wintertime. And it's not because there's not these viruses floating around in the middle of the summer. They are, but we're able to fight them off during the summer better, precisely because our immune systems are working better in the summertime. what if you know, in throughout the year we were boosting our immune systems so that we had basically summertime immune systems all year long? Maybe we wouldn't have a flu season. Wouldn't that be great?
What if the flu shot was replaced by an annual shot of your own immune system?
Sounds pretty great to me. I'll get in line for that.
Because not only would it prevent that particular flu, it would prevent any other flu coming along, or at least, you know, help to protect you against that, plus any cold.
Stomach virus, you name it. Anything. So, yeah, that would be a great thing.
Yeah, I'd like to see that coming down the pipe here pretty soon. And then finally, he talks about cognitive enhancement, and that kind of takes us full circle back to what do we mean about a singularity. Even if we don't get AGI, even if we don't get artificial general intelligence, even if we don't get molecular nanotechnology, the fact that we have substantially improved our, if not our intelligence, then at least our ability to manipulate the world around us through technology up to this point, and to now create treatments that will enhance our cognitive abilities, that we can actually go in and start tweaking the way our brains work and make them smarter. And I'll say it again, I think at that point you've just hit the true singularity once again, because once people get smarter, they can figure out other ways to get smarter, and it builds on itself.
Well, maybe the critics are right. Maybe we aren't smart enough to invent AGI as we are now. But what about after we've tweaked ourselves a little bit? How about then? You know, so
exactly.
It would be, you know, and hey, don't bet against something just because we've never done it before. If you go far enough into the past, you could say that about anything. You know, it's just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it can't be done.
Well, and in fact, there are so many balls in play now, so many more than there ever have been before. It seems to me there are so many paths, if not to the singularity, then to this kind of radical transformation of the world that I'm going to allow as a second definition of the singularity, that the chances that one of those is going to pan out is increased just by the fact that, you know, there are so many of them.
That's right.
If we only had one possible path to the singularity, then it would all depend on how likely that one thing is to happen. But when you start looking at all these different technologies and all these different possible ways we can improve our access to material goods, or improve our health, to extend our lives, to produce energy, you know, you're looking at a world that almost can't help but be fundamentally different over the next few decades. I mean, whatever wins, whatever comes out on top, with or without molecular nanotechnology, with or without AGI, we're going to be looking at a very different world, I would say, even 15, 20 years from now than the world we're living in now.
I think absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, I guess
that's a good place to close it. Yeah, I'm not going to improve on that, Phil.
Unless, Michael, we got any questions or comments from the chat room that you'd want to share with us?
I'm not smart enough to keep up with the chat room tonight, but let me just say that two things came up that I find an interesting, if not oblique, connection to tonight's show. Definitely the interesting tangent. One is Terrence McKenna and Time Wave Zero. And the other is the fact that on 12/21/2012, the world's going to end anyway.
Oh,
according to whom?
The Aztec calendar, right?
Oh, yeah.
Aztec calendar, guys with black helicopters, who knows?
Well, that's why I was kind of surprised that the X-Files movie came out this year. I was expecting, or maybe they were going to have one this year and then have one in 2012, because that was always the predicted end of the world on the X-Files, was actually that.
But it does definitely give some clarity to when to post-date your fantasy checks for. You know, if you're Homer Simpson and you're writing somebody $1 million check to buy the nuclear power plant, date it for 12/22/2012.
Well, I'll tell you what, we will, I guess that's Slorge Gridlock bringing this up there in the chat room. Slorge, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. We will try to do a Tales of the Paranormal on Terrence McKenna and Time Zero one of these days, because that is fun stuff, and I think we could we would enjoy talking about that a little bit further. But with that in mind, Stephen, I'm going to ask you what we got going on music-wise this evening.
Well, before we get into that, if you don't mind going just a couple minutes longer, I wanted to bring up your Declaration of Singularity that you wrote about, or just brought back in because of the 4th of July.
Sure.
I've noticed that you've had a couple of commenters, if not this year, maybe when you first published it, that thought that you were kind of playing fast and loose with a sacred document, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of comments that I mentioned in there that have come up in the past. One is that I'm disrespecting the Declaration of Independence by doing this Declaration of Singularity, and the other one is that clearly I'm down on democracy since this was the creation of our democratic government, and since I'm trying to improve on that or replace that with other language, I must think that the American Revolution was bad, and I want to create this machine dictatorship or something like that. And of course. To the first argument, I would say no offense intended. I think with all humility, the Thomas Jefferson and company would not object to somebody in this day and age using their document as a means of looking forward into other changes that might be coming. So I plead not guilty on that one. And the second one, that's just crazy. I'm all for the American Revolution. That's why I use the Declaration of Independence as the model, for heaven's sake.
You didn't go with Karl Marx's manifesto or anything. You went with
it's not like I took Mein Kampf and added a bunch of singularity language to that. I felt like this is, and this goes to our what do we mean by a singularity? In a sense, the Declaration of Independence talks about a singularity. It talks about a world transformed where people have said, hey, going to declare. We've got this notion of our own rights, and we're going to declare our own government based on the fact that we have the right to do that. And we're going to become a nation ourselves without anyone else saying that we're a nation, without any king on top or any of that other kind of stuff, because our right to do that is self-evident. It's a major step forward, not only in the history of this country, but in the history of this planet and in the history of this species. The Declaration of Independence reflects a major shift in how human beings looked at what government means and what their relationship to the state is and what their rights are, their basic fundamental rights are. So,
I would just say that. The thought that you're disrespecting this document by adding different language to freedom by its very nature means that no one can ever have the last word.
Constitution can be amended.
There's always the opportunity to adjust to the times, and that's precisely what you're kind of doing. But at the same time, you're also it's a tribute to the document as well. I saw this great show. Have you seen the special on John Adams?
On HBO? I've seen a couple of a few minutes of that. I haven't seen the whole show.
It is a great show, and what made me think about what you had done with the document was there's this great scene where Thomas Jefferson comes in with what he had written. And he shows it to John Adams. John Adams is moved to tears practically. Okay, John Adams was a man who was a very prideful kind of man, but he humbled himself and said, "I can't do it. I'm not as eloquent with my words as you are. You need to do it." And so Thomas Jefferson did it and brought it to John Adams. John Adams would not have changed a word of it. They handed it to Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin pulls out his red pen, He says, okay, this first thing here, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Actually, not self-evident. What he had said originally was, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. He says, it smacks of the pulpit. We want a secular government. How about we go with something a little more rationalist? Why don't we say that these truths are self-evident? And not that we're comparing ourselves to Benjamin Franklin by any means, but it's just that, you don't have the last word with these things. And another thing Benjamin Franklin said in that scene, at least, I don't know if this reflected reality or not, he says, this cannot be the work of one man. You know,
right.
it's got to be, there are going to be other people that weigh in on this before it becomes a declaration.
It took a bunch of them, took a bunch of them working together. Although I had always heard, this could be apocryphal, that, John Adams, objected to, Jefferson's use of the word inalienable. He said the real word is unalienable, and I followed Adams' usage in my declaration of singularity with unalienable. But that's the kind of thing, you know, Adams would, you know, he's not going to go in and change the big stuff. He's going to go, you know, hey, you missed a spot there. Oh,
yeah, he just, remember, it's a grammatical thing, but yeah, he didn't.
Yeah, a little bit of a grammatical thing. But I think the other thing I would clarify is I don't really predict that this will happen. I don't think there will be a Congress of the new post-human civilization. It'd be kind of cool if there was. We're all going to get together and declare our independence from the previous civilization. It's just, you know,
that's not likely to happen. What happened in Philadelphia during those years? Yeah, it's once in history kind of thing. It's not likely.
I don't see this actually happening. But I think the declaration makes a nice springboard for talking about those kinds of issues. And to me, the real fun part is not so much the part where I'm marking out government and writing in civilization or marking out mankind and putting in intelligent beings, but what's fun is to put together that list of grievances, which is the completely swapped out section. I mean, the Continental Congress and Jefferson had put in this list of grievances against King George. Well, I don't care about that, so I put in a list of grievances against the post-industrial world about all the, you know, crap that it has laid on us all these years in terms of artificial and arbitrary limits as to the duration of our lifespan and enforcing meaningless distinctions between labor and leisure, and you know, just a lot of the kinds of things that we look to see overcome from a speculative standpoint, and that's what we're declaring our independence from when the singularity occurs. It's we're declaring our independence from a world that has limited us in ways that we essentially will not allow ourselves to be limited in those ways any longer, and that's why I think the Declaration of Independence makes a great. Well, it's a great reading anyway. It's very seasonally appropriate. I did link to the real thing, and I recommend it to everyone. But it's a great model for anyone who wants to imagine the world transformed, and that's what we're all about here.
That's right. That's right. Okay, now let's get to the closing music, I guess.
Okay, what do you got?
Brother Love, the band Brother Love, comes back to Fast Forward Radio tonight. The song is Push.
Push. Now, what was the previous song we had by Brother Love?
Oh, you would quiz me on that.
Yeah, a little fast-forward music trivia for you there.
Ooh, it was it Turn It Up?
I think it might have been, yeah. You know what, you could have said anything right then, and I would have gone, I think it might have been, Steve.
Anyway, well, they're a great band, and I tell you what, in the show notes, I'll link to the last thing I played from Brother Love as well.
Okay, because, yeah, they're getting a call back here, so, you know.
Exactly, you want to hear it all.
They're starting to become regulars here on Fast Forward Radio.
No doubt.
All right, well, we'll look forward to reading those show notes. We'll look for those sometime tomorrow or the following day. Stephen, thank you very much. And thank you, Michael, and to all of our friends. Forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
Ciao.
Whoa.